Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fooled by the Winners, How Survivor Bias Deceives Us, by David Lockwood. Narrated by Jamie Haynes. The armor on the returning planes doesn't go where the bullet holes are. It goes where the bullet holes aren't. Jordan Ellenberg, referring to Abraham Wald's conclusions. The cemetery of failed restaurants is very silent. Nassim Taleb. Introduction. Ships, sailors, and prayers. Diagoras and the existence of the gods. The first person in history known to have written about survivor bias was the 5th century BC Greek philosopher Diagoras of Milos. Diagoras was a traveling poet who earned commissions from wealthy patrons by writing hymns to the gods. Diagoras is most famous as the first atheist. Ancient manuscripts reveal that Diagoras once wrote a poem that was stolen by another poet, who went on to achieve great success with the composition. Diagoras confronted the thief, who swore a solemn oath to the gods that the work was his. Furious at the man's refusal to admit to plagiarism, Diagoras implored the gods to punish the man for the appropriation of another's creative efforts, and for swearing a false oath. When this demand for retribution went unanswered, Diagoras lost faith in the Greek gods. Diagoras was challenged by a friend to defend his atheism. The friend pointed to paintings on the walls of the temples of sailors who were saved from violent storms after praying to the gods. The friend then asked, "You think the gods have no care for man? Why, you can see from all these votive pictures here how many people have escaped the fury of storms at sea by praying to the gods who have brought them safe to harbor." Diagoras replied, "Yes, indeed, but where are the pictures of all those who suffered shipwreck and perished in the waves?" As a result of this exchange, Diagoras secured his place in history as the first atheist and the first to explicitly call out survivor bias. In this example, Diagoras's friend focuses on the survivors of the storm. Those who perished, despite their pleas to the gods, were no longer among the living, and thus their images were not portrayed on murals throughout Athens. Diagoras's friend was fooled by the winners. By focusing only on those who survived the storms at sea and ignoring those who drowned, his friend was led to the wrong conclusion about the existence of the gods. Survivor bias. We are fooled by the winners because survivor bias distorts our thinking. Survivor bias has been defined as a logical error of concentrating on the people or things that made it past some selection process and overlooking those that did not. In other words, we fail to learn from the non-survivors, those who have lost. This tendency to focus on the winners is understandable. We are fooled by the winners because the winners, whether people, objects, data, or ships that return safely to port, are often easier to observe. But in many cases, we can derive as much or even more insight from those who have lost. I began to write this book after spending 3 decades working on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley, witnessing firsthand how survivor bias was used to deceive us. As I continued to investigate, I discovered that the deceptive influence of survivor bias on our thinking extends beyond what I had first imagined. Through the process of researching and writing this book, I uncovered a number of unexpected instances in which survivor bias impacts our daily lives. I also became convinced that survivor bias clouds our view of the past, which prevents us from gaining a clear view of our future. 2 types of survivor bias. Survivor bias comes in 2 types that are differentiated by our ability to observe the non-survivors. The first could be called Diagoras-type survivor bias. In the example of the Greek ships, Diagoras is the observer. He is able to count the number of ships that returned safely and those that did not. Even if all the ships foundered and were lost at sea, Diagoras could still observe that all the sailors had drowned. The second could be labeled sailor-type survivor bias. In this case, the observer is a sailor on one of the ships. A sailor is able to count the number of ships that left port and safely returned, but only if he survives the voyage. Just as in the case of Diagoras-type survivor bias, a sailor can be deceived upon returning to port by failing to consider the non-surviving ships, but he can be further misled if he does not realize that his observations are limited to only those instances in which he is still alive. About this book. This book is split into two parts. In part one, we will look at Diagoras-type survivor bias. We will hear how survivor bias is used by others to deceive us into overpaying hedge fund managers, taking pills that don't cure our ills, following the bad advice of many advice books, overspending on lotteries, opening restaurants that are likely to close, and suffering through diets that don't help us lose weight. We will show how a professor discovered during World War II that Allied Bomber Command was deceived by survivor bias, and that even today, history is still written by the winners. In part two, we will examine sailor-type survivor bias. We will demonstrate how survivor bias distorts our perspective on evolutionary history, including our good fortune that 65 million years ago, a space rock targeted our planet, wiping out the dinosaurs, and that, against all odds, 50,000 years ago, we vanquished at least five other human species. We will analyze how survivor bias misleads us about the dangers of atomic weapons and global warming. We will also see how survivor bias aids the resolution of Fermi's paradox, the puzzle concerning the existence of intelligent life in the universe, and provides insights into the mortality of Schrödinger's cat, one of the most important questions in modern physics. Previous studies of survivor bias have been inaccessible to most, housed in formula-laden statistical journals or tucked away in academic papers written for subject area experts. But you won't find any math or technical jargon here. Instead, we will apply the concept of survivor bias to concrete, real-world examples. Just because math is my favorite subject does not mean it should be yours. We will put flesh on the bones of this theoretical concept by working through examples, minus the equations. As each example is discussed in turn, we will examine how survivor bias is used to deceive us and how we manage to deceive ourselves. Then, we will set out ways to correct for survivor bias, so we are not fooled by the winners. We begin with survivor bias in financial services. The first person to call out how survivor bias is used to deceive us in financial services was a New York stockbroker who wrote a book in 1940 that remains to this day one of the most quoted texts on the subject of Wall Street. The stockbroker began his book with a question about boats. Part 1. Chapter 1. Financial Services, So Much for So Little. Fred Schwed and Customer Yachts. Fred Schwed, 1902 to 1966, was, in the terminology of his day, a customer's man. For almost two decades, he worked for the Wall Street firm of Edwin Wolfe, hawking stocks to retail investors. Today, he would be called a registered representative, or, more commonly, a stockbroker. In his spare time, he wrote books, including a popular children's novel, Wacky the Small Boy, a bestseller during the 1930s. Schwed was the son of a member of the New York Curb Exchange, later renamed the New York Stock Exchange. In 1924, after graduating from Columbia University, he went to work on Wall Street. The 1920s was a period of rampant speculation when the allure of a booming market and cheap margin debt seduced millions of individuals to place their life savings into stocks. After the equity markets crashed in 1929, Wall Street and the nation were plunged into a depression that lasted until World War II. In fact, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, DJIA, did not return to its 1929 height in absolute terms until 1958. So, during the many years he worked on Wall Street, Schwed experienced the best and worst of times. Schwed developed a keen eye for the foibles and follies of his colleagues, and shaped his observations into pithy anecdotes. In 1940, he cast his thoughts into a humorous and insightful short book entitled Where Are the Customers' Yachts? Or A Good Hard Look at Wall Street. The title of Schwed's book comes from his observation that Wall Street is a more profitable place to work than to invest. Schwed wrote, "Once in the dear dead days beyond recall, an out-of-town visitor was being shown the wonders of the New York financial district. When the party arrived at the Battery, one of his guides indicated some handsome ships riding at anchor. He said, 'Look, those are the bankers' and brokers' yachts.' 'Where are the customers' yachts?' asked the naive visitor." Today, the financial services industry continues to be a lucrative place to earn a living. In Schwed's words, Wall Street is the highest-paying spot on the face of the earth. The financial sector of the U.S. economy employs fewer than 5% of all U.S. workers, yet claims almost 30% of all corporate profits. The financial sector is extraordinarily profitable due to the economics of its primary business, managing the savings and investments of the nation, or what is known as asset management. For U.S. securities firms, asset management is critically important, accounting for just over half of total revenue. The asset management business is extraordinarily profitable partly because of the way it charges investors. Unlike many other service industries, most financial services professionals are paid on a percentage basis. By contrast, lawyers bill per hour, regardless of the size of the transaction. This makes sense. The cost of a lawyer's time is the same, whether the deal to be negotiated is for $100 million or $1 million. But charging a percentage of assets under management is the most common fee arrangement for fund managers. For instance, hedge funds typically collect fees of 1 to 2% of assets under management and 20% of all investment gains. Hence, a hedge fund manager charges 100 times more for investing $100 million than $1 million. The same applies to wealth advisors and mutual fund managers, who generally charge a fee based on a percentage of assets. The exceptional profitability of the asset management business is reflected in employee compensation. The average mutual fund portfolio manager earns about $1.3 million in salary and bonuses. At a hedge fund, that number is $1.4 million. Those at the very top of the U.S. hedge fund industry are paid even more. In 2017, the 25 highest compensated hedge fund managers were paid an average of $615 million each. Assuming a 250-day work year and 10-hour days, that equates to $246,000 per hour. In the United States, the average worker earns an hourly wage of $27. These unusual levels of compensation can make headlines. A prominent hedge fund manager was reported to have purchased a second home in New York for $250 million. No similar purchases are known to have been made by his investors. The justification for the extraordinary amounts of money paid to hedge fund managers is that they outperform the market indexes. There would be no reason to pay a hedge fund manager to match market returns. An index fund achieves that result without the exorbitant fees. To convince investors to pay these fees, hedge fund managers offer, quote, proof of their ability to generate returns in excess of market benchmarks. But the proof put forward is riddled with survivor bias. Schwed warned us of this in 1940. He wrote, "Figures, as used in financial argument, seem to have the bad habit of expressing a small part of the truth forcibly and neglecting the other part, as do some people we know." John Merriweather and LTCM. John Merriweather is an example of how the failure to adjust for survivor bias benefits hedge fund managers. Merriweather grew up in Chicago and from an early age was an avid gambler. As a teenager, he bet on horses, blackjack, baseball, and golf, a sport in which he excelled. He graduated from Northwestern University, taught high school math for a year, and then went to the University of Chicago, earning an MBA in 1973. He was hired by Salomon Brothers after business school and joined the fledgling fixed income department. In 1977, he founded the Arbitrage Group within Salomon Brothers. The name was apt. Rather than betting on the absolute price change in a security, Merriweather specialized in betting on the change in the relative price difference between two fixed income instruments, or what is known as bond arbitrage. In the late 1970s and 1980s, the Arbitrage Group at Salomon Brothers enjoyed a number of successful years, and generated a substantial portion of the firm's profits, Meriwether soon climbed to one of the top rungs of the Salomon Brothers corporate ladder. However, in 1991, Meriwether and his arbitrage group submitted a series of false bids to the U.S. Treasury in order to gain a disproportionate share of newly issued securities. The resulting crisis almost bankrupted the brokerage firm. To restore faith in the firm, Warren Buffett stepped in as CEO, and Meriwether resigned, although Meriwether defended his actions and those of the arbitrage group to the very end. The SEC charged Meriwether with the civil crime of failing to supervise his employees, and he settled with the SEC, agreeing to a 3-month suspension from the securities business and a $10,000 fine. After he left, Salomon Brothers recovered, and the firm was sold to Citigroup in 1997. After departing Salomon, Meriwether founded Long-Term Capital Management, LTCM. His pitch to investors was that he would undertake the same arbitrage strategies at LTCM that had proven successful at Salomon Brothers. He also recruited a number of leading academics and brought many of his former colleagues from Salomon Brothers to the new hedge fund. Some were surprised that Meriwether, after being fined and suspended from the securities business by the SEC and almost bankrupting his firm, could raise monies from investors. However, he persuaded enough individual and institutional investors to trust him with their savings to open his new fund in 1994 with over $1 billion in capital. He pitched Warren Buffett to invest, but Buffett declined. From 1994 to 1997, the returns on investor capital at LTCM substantially exceeded the market indexes, and the firm steadily grew in size. By the early months of 1998, total capital under management had risen to $4.7 billion. And then, it all went pear-shaped. During 1998, the Asian financial crisis weighed heavily on the debt and other financial markets. Returns for LTCM turned sharply negative in May of that year and continued to be negative throughout the summer months. In August, Russia declared a debt moratorium, effectively suspending payment on Russian-issued government bonds, sending emerging market debt into a tailspin. Investors around the world fled to the safety of more liquid, higher-rated securities. By the end of August, LTCM had lost almost $2 billion in capital. LTCM lost money primarily because the firm had been betting that the spread would narrow between higher-rated, more liquid securities and those with a lower rating and less liquidity. From the founding of LTCM in 1994 to 1997, LTCM's bet paid off, as the difference in price between these two groups of securities had steadily declined. However, during times of crisis, investors flee to the security of higher-rated and more liquid securities. The summer of 1998 was no exception, and the spread between these two groups of securities significantly widened. By September, LTCM had lost another $2 billion and was insolvent. In response, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York took control of LTCM from Meriwether and liquidated most of his investments. LTCM investors were almost entirely wiped out, and the banks that had lent money to the firm incurred substantial losses. LTCM's largest creditor, UBS, lost $780 million, and its chairman was forced to resign. Not surprisingly, LTCM did not report results to the hedge fund indexes for 1998. If LTCM had reported results, investor returns would have been a negative 91% for that year. During the period in which the firm was part of the hedge fund indexes, from 1994 to 1997, LTCM reported that investors gained an average of 32% per year. However, from 1994 to 1998, including returns from that last non-reporting year, LTCM lost investors an average of 27% per year. From 1994 to 1997, the returns of LTCM were included in the major hedge fund indexes. Once LTCM closed up shop, performance of the fund was deleted from the historical returns of those indexes. Survivor bias and hedge fund performance. LTCM is an example of how investors evaluating the performance of hedge funds as an asset class can draw the wrong conclusions due to survivor bias. The returns reported by a hedge fund index contain only the past performance of the surviving funds. The non-survivors, such as LTCM, are excluded from the indexes. A hedge fund index should really be called an index of not failed hedge funds. Hence, due to survivor bias, hedge fund indexes overstate the performance of hedge funds as an asset class. This is particularly true because the rate of hedge fund failure is high. If only a small percentage of funds ceased operations each year, the effect of survivor bias on hedge fund indexes would be minimal. But this has not been the case. In a study of 720 hedge funds that started 20 years ago, only 262 were still operating after the first decade and only 13 after the second. Another study of over 1,000 hedge funds showed that from 2004 to 2014, fewer than half that started at the beginning of the period were still in business 10 years later. As expected, the number of hedge fund closures varies with market conditions. One survey showed 16% of hedge funds had dissolved in 2007, but that number increased to 31% in 2008 during the financial crisis. And not all hedge fund closures are involuntary. The compensation structure of hedge funds provides an incentive for a hedge fund manager to close up shop after a bad year. Hedge fund compensation. Never having to say you're sorry. Investors typically agree to pay hedge fund managers 20% of investment gains each year, or what is known as carried interest. In financial terms, a hedge fund manager receives a free call option that can be exercised each year based on performance over the previous 12 months. But if a fund manager loses money one year, then those losses have to be made up before additional carried interest can be paid. This feature of hedge fund compensation is known as a high watermark. An example illustrates this point. Suppose a hedge fund manager is given $100 to invest. In year one, the portfolio gains 20% and is now worth $120, a gain of $20. The hedge fund manager will typically receive 20% of the profits, or $4 of carried interest and compensation for year one. In year two, the portfolio declines by 50% and is now worth $60. There are no profits, so the hedge fund manager receives no carried interest. But the high watermark remains at $120. Even if in year three the value of the portfolio doubles to $120, the manager will receive no carried interest. Additional carried interest will be paid only if the portfolio becomes worth more than $120 in subsequent years. However, things still worked out just fine for the hedge fund manager, since she gets paid at the end of each year. In our example, even though over 2 years she lost $40 of her investor's $100, she was still paid $4 in carried interest to do so. Unfortunately for investors, after her disastrous performance in year two, there is an incentive for the hedge fund manager to bank her $4 and close up shop. From the perspective of the hedge fund manager, she will be working for free until the value of the investor's portfolio reaches the high water mark of $120, an increase of 100% in the value of the portfolio. She is financially better off leaving to start a new hedge fund, unburdened with overcoming the hurdle of the old high water mark due to her failed performance. In the case of LTCM, Merriweather was forced out, but even if he hadn't been, he had little incentive to continue. With a loss of 91% during the final year, Merriweather would have had to work many years before he saw another bonus from carried interest, if ever. In fact, like many in the hedge fund industry who fail, Merriweather promptly started a new fund. In 2000, Merriweather launched JWM Partners with some of his former colleagues from LTCM. The fund was successful until 2008, but then suffered large losses during the financial crisis. JWM Partners was dissolved in 2009. In 2010, Merriweather opened a new fund, JM Management. Admittedly, not all hedge fund managers have been able to fail and then open new funds repeatedly, like Merriweather. It is also difficult to determine what percentage of hedge fund closures are voluntary versus involuntary. In many cases, the decision is probably mutual. Regardless, As we have heard, the vast majority of hedge funds fail. This high rate of failure has led to significant survivor bias in the hedge fund indexes. For the 10-year period ending in 2014, survivor bias increased the nominal returns of one hedge fund index by 26%. Another study exposed that from 1996 to 2003, survivor bias raised the performance of a different hedge fund index by 47%. Survivor bias and mutual fund performance. The indexes measuring the performance of mutual fund managers are similarly distorted by survivor bias. Mutual funds are subject to the same high rates of failure as hedge funds. During the period from 1997 to 2011, only 54% of mutual funds managed to survive. Another study found failure rates of 78% to 95% for different types of mutual funds over a 20-year period. Not surprisingly, funds that go out of business underperform those that don't. One study of over 5,000 mutual funds found that the surviving funds outperformed the non-survivors by more than 20% on average. As a result, mutual fund indexes overstate performance by excluding the returns of the non-survivors. This is confirmed by comparisons of mutual fund performance and the market indexes with and without the non-survivors. A study of large-cap value funds found that 62% had beaten the market averages over the past 5 years. However, once mutual funds that had gone out of business were included, the percentage of outperformers fell to 46%, no better than chance. The same study established that during the last 15 years, the percentage of outperformers fell from 50 to 27% with the inclusion of non-surviving funds. Another study examined 39,000 mutual funds over an even longer period, 50 years, and found that 13,000 had died. Individual investors are sold mutual funds on the basis of past performance. This past performance is typically calculated by your neighborhood stockbroker who, consciously or not, fails to correct for survivor bias in his sales pitch. Stockbrokers charge fees to investors in exchange for a promise of better investment returns. A common means of collecting fees is to sell you a mutual fund run by a fund manager who's supposed to be better at picking stocks than you are. The fund manager ought to be better than you or the index. Otherwise, there's no reason to pay two sets of high fees, one to the fund manager to pick stocks and another to your stockbroker for introducing you to a fund manager to pick stocks for you. After all, anyone could buy stocks through an online brokerage firm or invest in an index fund for a nominal charge. To justify two sets of high fees, your stockbroker presents color-coded, bar-graphed, outside-audited financial statements demonstrating that over the past 10 years, the recommended fund manager has outperformed the market averages by wide margins. Your neighborhood stockbroker claims this is due to the fund manager's superior stock-picking acumen. If the stockbroker's firm started one mutual fund 10 years ago, and that fund outperformed the market for 10 years, then this particular fund manager may be highly skilled. However, if the stockbroker's firm started 10 mutual funds 10 years ago, and the other 9 subsequently went out of business due to lousy performance, then you should include all 10 funds in your assessment of the brokerage house's investment chops. It could be that the one remaining mutual fund manager was just plain good or just plain lucky. It could also be true that the brokerage firm is not so good at picking fund managers, given that 9 out of 10 fund managers at the firm failed. Admittedly, the causes of the poor performance may be difficult to determine, but if the fund offered to you is the only one of 10 funds still around, then the proposition that the manager of that fund possesses superior stock-picking skills is an example of the deceptive influence of survivor bias on our thinking. In many cases, what your neighborhood stockbroker is really selling is a mutual fund manager who has benefited more from good fortune than adept portfolio management. Our neighborhood stockbroker is touting one of the few surviving funds while passing over the more numerous non-surviving funds in silence. Your stockbroker hopes you will be fooled by the winners. One way to test for survivor bias in mutual funds is to ask your stockbroker for a list of all the funds that he recommended 10 years ago, or ask for a report on the performance of the firm's mutual funds that includes those that were shut down over the last decade. the non-survivors. I've done this myself. To date, no such reports have arrived in my inbox.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?